Today's talk is titled Unemployment and Inequality, A Path Forward by Dean Baker. Dean Baker was one of the earliest economists to foresee the housing bubble and predict the recession of 2008. He is co-director of the Center for Economic Policy and Research in Washington, D.C. The talk was held on April 4, 2014, on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus and sponsored by the Madison Institute.
It's good to be back here. My talk, I wanted to base on my new book, and I'm really embarrassed to say I was going to bring a copy just to hold up, and you know what I found was my old book. The new book's called, of course, Getting Back to Full Employment, A Better Bargain for Working People, which I really like. I like the title, the cover. I argued with my co-author, Jared Bernstein, about the cover. It's got what looks like Walmart. We actually had an original publisher refuse to do that because they were worried about being sued. It's called Sprawmart. And it says, now hiring $15 an hour plus benefits. Jared didn't want the plus benefits. I said, no, it's got to say plus benefits. Point being that if we actually had something like full employment, Walmart would have to pay $15 an hour plus benefits. So that's kind of the gist of it. I'll come back to that in a second, but I will market my old book, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And that dog on my cover, I don't know how good your eyesight is, but that dog is one of my dogs, little Bichon on the cover. People were exploiting him. But you could download this for free, as with my new book. When I first came out with one of these other books, I've gotten the habit, I really like to distribute the books free because I'm not going to make a fortune on my books. I'm happy to get them out there. And so anyhow, when I first did this with the book, I remember, you know, I had it on a blog and someone posted, they thought they were really smart. They said, oh, you know, Baker's making this available for free. I'm going to make lots of copies and sell them and make lots of money. So the next person go, yeah, that will get him really angry. So anyhow, if any of you want to sell them and make lots of money, please do. But both are available to be downloaded. Okay, I want to make three main points in my talk. First off, that the story of inequality is to a large extent, I'm not going to say it's by any means the whole story, but to a large extent, important extent, is a story of high unemployment. And the basic story that, you know, we show in our book, it's easy to document, is that we've had much higher unemployment over the last three decades when we've seen increasing inequality than in the prior three decades. You know, we often talk about a golden age, the period right after World War II, from late 40s to the early mid-70s, when basically people's incomes grew together. Everyone was sharing in prosperity. And, you know, again, not to say everything was great. I'm just saying things were going in the right direction. So first off, that is a big part of the story, that we've had high unemployment in the last three decades, at least relative to the period immediately after World War II. Secondly, that, you know, we've had a weak recovery, and that should not be a surprise. So some of you, if you came here 4 years ago, I'm going to say the same thing I said 4 years ago. We had a big housing bubble. It burst. There's nothing to fill the gap. I find the story very simple, and it's a little amazing to me that, you know, it's sort of like, you know, you found your keys and people are looking around. Well, where are the keys? Where are the keys? Right here. You know, where are the keys? It's a very simple story. I've come to say that, you know, the economy's too simple for economists to understand. I think that's basically a story. Then I want to say a little bit about how we can counter the weakness. You know, what would it take? And again, I don't think that's very complicated. But again, it is worth going through and just explaining what do we have to do to get the economy recover. And, you know, Fred was talking about the jobs report. You know, it's one of these things. You go, okay, you know, it's always, you go, it could be worse. You know, we had 192,000 jobs. Sure, it could be worse. I have friends in the administration who are going, well, you know, at least we're creating jobs, you know. Yeah, but, you know, at this rate, and, you know, I do a write-up of the report every month, at this rate, you need roughly 90, 100,000 a month to keep pace with the rate of job labor force growth. You know, we're a growing country, growing labor force. So you need roughly 90,000 a month. You do the arithmetic on it, we get back to full employment somewhere around 2020. I don't think anyone could be very happy about that. So I want to go through, you know, what we could do to speed that up. Obviously, they're big political obstacles, but what it would take, what sort of policies it would take to speed that up. Okay, first story, unemployment in the Nehru. We we have a concept, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, which I don't particularly like, but economists use this a lot. The Congressional Budget Office uses this a lot. It's used to guide policy. The idea of the NARA, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, is that it sort of sets a floor. If you believe the story, it sort of sets a floor saying how low the unemployment rate can get before you start to see accelerating inflation. Next question is, how do you know where that is? Well, the answer is we don't know very well. But one of the things that you could do very easily is you could just take the numbers, the estimates that come from the Congressional Budget Office. These are, you know, presumably, you know, I will say they're impartial. They come up with their estimates of the NARA. And you could use that as sort of a first guidepost, which is not to say that I accept their estimates. I've argued with them at length, and, you know, I would say their numbers today are too high. I'd say they've generally been too high. In other words, the unemployment rate could get lower than what they're saying. But just as a simple starting point, if you look at that, and this is one of the things we did in our book, if you look at the unemployment rate relative to what the Congressional Budget Office estimates as the NARA, on average, we were considerably below the NARA in this period from 47 to 79. So if you just added it up, did a very simple thing. You just took every quarter and said, are we above the NARA or below the NARA? Today, they have about 5.5 as the NARA. So today, the unemployment rate is 6.7. If that were 6.7 all quarter, we'd say that's 1.2 percentage points above the NARA. Okay, on the other hand, if we were at 5, we'd say half a percentage point below the NARA. Very simple thing, about as simple as you can get. All right, so if you just did that and you looked 49 to 79, we were a cumulative total of 15 percentage points below their estimate of the NARA. Okay, so in other words, going back over that you know, roughly a little more than three decade period, on average, the unemployment rate was below what the Congressional Budget Office said the NARA was. Okay, on average, about a half percentage point below. Okay, that changes. If we take the period 1980 to 2012, we're about 31 percentage points above the NARA. Okay, so that's saying that roughly an average of a percentage point a year above their estimate in the NARA. And if you think, well, things really went to hell in 2008, which of course they did, so we pulled that out. We said, let's just take 1980 to 2007. Okay, over that period, we're about 18 percentage points. That's an average of about 6 or 7 tenths of a percentage point a year above their estimate of the NARA. Okay, so without even asking, you know, is this estimate of the NARA right? You know, have they gotten it right? Is it higher? And it actually was higher in the later period than the earlier period. So in other words, it was a lower bar to be at the NARA. We were considerably higher relative to the NARA in the period since 1980 than the period before 1980. Okay, so the simple story that we just take away from that is that unemployment was on average considerably higher relative to the economy's potential. We're taking their measure of the economy's potential, not ours, in that second period than the first period. So as a result of that, the workers at the middle and bottom had less opportunity to put upward pressure on their wages. And if you look again at what happened with wage growth, and we have a nice, I consider a nice chart in our paper that looks at, in our book, we look at wage growth by, you know, by the middle, by the bottom quintile and top quintile. What you see in the first three decades, the period from 47 to 79, those track almost perfectly. In fact, income for people at the bottom rose a little bit more quickly. I won't make a big deal out of the more, but, you know, if you just look at the numbers, it rose a little bit more quickly than incomes at the middle and income at the top. Basically, you know, from 47 to 79, you have the story you'd like to see, that there was strong economic growth, and you actually saw people at the bottom benefiting somewhat more than people at the top. So everyone's gaining, people at the bottom are gaining a little bit more than those at the top. Very different story if we look at the period since 79. Basically, people at the bottom quintile, have had very little by way of benefits of economic growth. People in the middle, a bit more, about 15% over the last three decades, 15% or so. Most of that, I should say, by more people working, so you have more two-earner families. And most of the gains have gone to people at the top. Now, I should qualify that because I have a friend, a economist at Brookings, Gary Burles, who always yells at people about this. It actually looks a little bit better if you look at after-tax income. And the reason for that is that we've had somewhat more progressive, not so much on the tax side, but transfer side. So we have things like the Earned Income Tax Credit. Good program, helps a lot of people at the bottom end. Of course, Social Security. Okay, Social Security is great great support for people in retirement. It's a reason why we don't have a lot more retirees in poverty than we actually do. So if you take those into account, the situation's not great, but it's not quite as bad as that. In other words, you still get a situation where the vast majority of gains over the last three decades have gone to those at the top. I'm saying top quintile, but we could boil it down. Really, it's the 1%. But in any case, those at the top, where those at the middle and bottom have gained very little. And again, they do a little bit better if we take after-tax income than if we take before-tax income. Okay, just to give you some numbers, I promise not to bombard you with numbers, but just to give you some numbers, because we did some analysis to try to quantify this. We just were curious to see what we found. Our calculation showed that if you had a sustained period of lower unemployment, so you lower the unemployment rate by one percentage point and sustain that. So imagine that, you know, we snapped our fingers, we got the employment rate down from 6.7 to 5.7%, and we held it there for, let's say, the next decade. That would lead to an increase in wages for those in the bottom quintile, men in the bottom quintile, of about 12.4%. Okay, it's a big deal. Okay, so someone earning $10 an hour, $20,000 a year, that translates into gains of about $2,500 over the course of a year. Okay, that big deal. For women, gains aren't quite as large, but still substantial, about 9%. Okay, so a woman worker, it ends up being about $1,800, a woman worker earning $10 an hour, $20,000 a year. The middle quintile, it's about 4% for both men and women. Okay, so still substantial, still a very big gain, but not quite as substantial for those at the bottom. And if you go to the top end, if you go to the 90th percentile, basically it's insignificant. Okay, so there's no detectable effect. So the point of this analysis is that when you get to lower unemployment rates, again, it benefits, you know, the numbers were mostly still positive, even at the 90th percentile, but the big gains are for those at the middle and bottom. And if you think about it for a moment, I'll say it makes a lot of sense to me. You can decide whether it makes sense to you. When a firm lays off workers, you know, they see less demand, it's not typically the CEOs, it's not typically the supervisors that are getting laid off. Who are they laying off? They're laying off, you know, if you're looking at a factory, they're laying off the assembly line worker. If you're looking at a retail store, they're laying off a retail clerk. So it tends to be people at the bottom end who feel that most harshly. So when you get a situation where there's high unemployment, it's those workers who are at the middle and particularly the bottom who are most vulnerable, see the most layoffs, see the biggest increase in their unemployment rate, and the biggest decline in their bargaining power. And of course, that works in reverse. When we create a tight labor market, they're the ones who see gains. And, you know, part of our motivation writing this book, we were both very impressed. I mean, we wrote the earlier book in 2003, but, you know, we thought it was worth going back, revisiting it. We have more data. We were very impressed in the late 90s that we got the unemployment rate down to 4%, lower than anyone thought possible. I'll say something about that in a moment. But we got the unemployment rate down to 4% for a full year. And during that time, not just that time, 97, 98, 99, 2000, we saw real wage gains up and down the income distribution, up and down the wage ladder. And that was the only time since the early 70s that you saw broadly based wage gains. So if you go through the 80s, you go through the early mid 90s, workers at the middle and bottom, there were some years where they had small wage gains, but there was no period where they had sustained wage gains. That period, the late 90s through 2000, you saw workers at the middle and bottom getting strong wage gains. So a lot of other things I should point out. You saw, you know, a lot of people being pulled into the labor market that otherwise probably never would have had a chance. So there were stories in the business press about companies that were in the suburbs, you know, a hotel or a restaurant in the suburbs. They couldn't find workers, you know, in their usual pool in the suburbs. They're arranging to bus people out from the inner cities. So they would have, they'd charter private buses. They would, you know, have pick people up on corners, take them out to the suburbs, because otherwise people couldn't get there. They don't have cars. They couldn't afford the gas, you know, so they would actually bus people out there. They don't really do that. You know, they'd rather not do that. But, you know, when they needed workers, that's what they would do. They're hiring people with disabilities. They were hiring people who were former prisoners. Okay, these are not people that employers ordinarily like to hire. But, you know, when the unemployment rate's low, they can't be picky. You know, they need people to work, and, you know, other people have other options. So what do? They hire people that they would ordinarily not hire. So we had some really great stories there. They also did things they wouldn't ordinarily do. There were, you know, I always got a kick out reading the business press. Then they say, oh, you know, look what employers have to do. They're offering child care. And I remember one story, not only are they offering child care, they're offering elder care. So I said, you know, some workers have, you know, elderly parents that they have to take care of. And, you know, they make arrangements, they help facilitate arrangements so that they could, you know, come in and work and have, you know, people who need care taken care of during their working hours. So a lot of the things that we might like to see were happening during that period when we got the unemployment rate down to 4%. Now, the last point I want to make about that, and I love to throw this at economists because, you know, there's an incredible arrogance among economists that, you know, they really have no right to. I mean, I say this all seriousness. I mean, their expertise shouldn't be built on the fact that they have a degree from MIT. Their expertise should be built on the fact they've been right. And they can't say that much, you know. And, you know, they obviously were wrong in missing the housing bubble, which, you know, again, I'll go into in a second. But the other thing that they were wrong on in a really big way was how low the unemployment rate could go. You know, they like to brush this under the table, but I remember this very well. I went to Washington in 92, and it was an absolute matter of gospel among economists. I don't just mean, you know, kind of right-wing George W. Bush types. It was an absolute gospel among, you know, centrist, even left-of-center economists, you know, certainly Clinton administration economists, that the unemployment rate couldn't get below 6 or much below 6% without triggering inflation. And I, in fact, remember having a conversation. I once had an opportunity to meet with Alan Blinder, who's a prominent economist, good economist, too. I don't mean to knock him. I have a lot of respect for Alan Blinder. But he was at the Federal Reserve Board at the time. And Janet Yellen, who was also at the Federal Reserve Board at the time. She wasn't chair, but they're both governors on the Federal Reserve Board. And we were arguing about how low the unemployment rate could go. And I was trying to give evidence that, you know, look, there's reasons to believe it could get well below 6%, 5%, or maybe even lower without triggering inflation. And both of them were just completely dismissive, you know, just like, no, that's just silly, you know, can't get below 6%. And the reason why it got below 6%, you know, I trash Greenspan all the time, and I'll trash him here today talking about the bubble, but the reason it got below 6% was Greenspan was non-orthodox economist. Whatever you want to say about the guy, he's not a mainstream economist, he's not an orthodox economist, he has eclectic views on the economy. And when the unemployment rate got below 6%, it was about 5.6, 5.7 back in the mid-90s, 95, 96, the other economists on the Fed, including the Clinton appointees, including Janet Yellen, they were yelling at Alan Greenspan, you have to raise interest rates, we're going to have inflation. And Greenspan said, I don't see any inflation. You know, why should I raise interest rates? Why shouldn't I let the economy keep growing? Why shouldn't I let the unemployment rate fall? And he was absolutely right. And the only reason why Jared and I could look back and say, hey, here's what happens when the unemployment rate gets below 6%, when you get 5%, 4% unemployment, is because we had this quirky guy at the Fed. If that wasn't the case, you know, it could have been a Clinton appointee. We never would have had that opportunity. And then they could all say, yeah, unemployment rate can't get below 6%. What are you talking about? Okay, so it was really kind of a quirk, you know, that was an absolute, as I say, it was very much against the consensus view in the profession that the unemployment rate could get that low without triggering inflation. And it didn't trigger inflation, by the way, just to be clear. We looked at it very carefully, you know. You see some very minor ticks, depending which data series, you know, you can have some very minor ticks, but if you go, oh my God, that's the cost of having 4% unemployment, you know, it's really laughable. And I can pick series that are very credible series. In fact, the ones that the Fed used mostly, zero ticks, no change in the rate of inflation. The rate of inflation at the end of 2000, when we went through the recession in 2001, was actually lower than it was back in 96 when it first fell below their measure of the Nehru. Okay, so long and short, the evidence from the 90s is we can get to much lower rates of unemployment than most people thought, than what's held up today. Today, as I was saying, 5.5% is the number that the Congressional Budget Office uses, that many economists uses. We'd love to get there, but you know, we would argue we can get much lower. There's no reason to see that as a floor. And again, when you do that, our evidence, you know, our takeaway is that we will see wage growth at the middle and the bottom. And until then, it's unlikely we will see much. And you know, that's the basic story. If you look at what's happened, well, we could even go back to 2000, but certainly since the downturn, basically wages for most workers have gone nowhere. Been at best flat, maybe even down, depending, you know, exactly what time period you look at. So basically most workers are not seeing, certainly workers at the middle and bottom, are not seeing any gains from economic growth in the last, you know, 6 or 7 years, and arguably since 2000. All right, question, why the economy is so weak, why the recovery is so slow? To my mind, as I say, there's not really a mystery. The only mystery here is why it's a mystery. You know, to my mind, you know, look, we had a housing bubble that was driving the economy. Bubble burst. End of story. How is the bubble driving the economy? Well, two ways. One, very directly, record high house prices led to record high rates of construction. That's kind of straightforward. You know, you see real high house prices, you build a house quickly, you sell it, you make lots of money. So you go back and you look at construction in the years 2002 to 2006. It was at near record levels as a share of the economy. Didn't fit our demographics at all. Now everyone's pointing out baby boomers are retiring. Somehow people didn't notice it then. You know, we didn't just drop from, I'm a baby boomer, you know, if it's not obvious. We didn't just drop from the air, you know. Baby boomers were entering their 50s and even 60s, you know, during the bubble years. And what that meant was that, you know, people, you know, tends to be the case when you get in your 50s, 60s, you know, a lot of people raise families, they're moving into smaller homes. You know, so our demographic bulge should have been less housing, not more housing. So anyhow, we were building housing at near record rates in the bubble years. The other part of the story was, you know, my calculations, we had about $8 trillion of bubble-generated equity. This simple story just said, okay, let's look at the value of housing at the peak of the bubble, 2006, and compare that to what it would have been if house prices had just followed their trend path. And I get about $8 trillion. Well, it's an old economic theory, housing wealth effect. I have no idea where that first originated, but it was pretty old when I was in grad school. So it probably goes back 70, 80, 90 years. Anyhow, the idea is people spend based on their housing wealth. So you had all these people, they bought a home for $150,000, $200,000, now it's worth $300,000 or $400,000. Well, they spend in part based on that equity. Okay, not a stupid thing to do unless the equity is illusory. Okay, but that's something, you know, if you made a lot of money on your house, why shouldn't you spend some of it? And a lot of people did that. So a lot of people took out second mortgages, they took out home equity loans, might have used it to pay for their kids' school, maybe they took it to take a vacation. One thing a lot of people did was they said, why should I put money in a 401k? The house is doing it for me. Okay, so a lot of people were saving less, they were spending more. Again, predictable effect of, you know, this big housing wealth effect, not a big surprise. Okay, so what happens? The bubble burst and, okay, construction plummets. Okay, rather from being a situation where you're building homes at near record rates, we're basically building homes at record low rates. Because not only do we no longer have the bubble, but we have enormous oversupply of housing. I'll come back to that in a minute. And the other part of the story is, you know, the consumption, the wealth that was driving consumption, it's gone. You can't take out a home equity loan if you don't have any home equity. You know, that's not a big surprise, you know. So that was the basic story of the downturn. And when people are asking, well, why is the recovery so slow? Well, we have nothing to replace the demand generated by the bubble. And just to make a simple point, you know, I'm not a partisan Democrat. I argue with the Obamaites all the time. But just to make a simple point, when you have Republicans going, oh, when we had our president in the White House, you know, Ronald Reagan, blah, blah, blah. Different sort of recession. You know, 1981, 1982, very steep recession, very different sort of recession. 1981, 1982, very steep recession. The unemployment rate got, I think it peaked at 10.8%. So in that sense, it was even worse. But it was very short. Economy comes back in 83, is growing very rapidly. Well, why was that? Different sort of recession. That was brought on quite deliberately by the Fed. I don't mean they wanted the unemployment rate to go that high, but they raised interest rates with the idea of slowing the economy to slow inflation. Okay, we had double-digit inflation. You had Paul Volcker at the Fed. I won't go back and argue whether it's the right thing to do or not, but I don't think we could argue this is what he did. He raised interest rates. We got the short-term interest rates were at one point, I think, at 18%. So he sent interest rates through the roof, sent mortgage rates through the roof. So what did that do? That sent car buying through the floor, and most importantly, it sent housing through the floor. So housing construction just plummeted. Now, the good part of a story like that is we know how to get out of recession like that. You lower interest rates. Okay, it doesn't take a genius, and that's what the Fed did. And when they lowered interest rates, there's all this pent-up demand for housing, pent-up demand for cars. So, woo, goes like that. You could find quarters where housing was growing at like a 40% annual rate. Okay, so it's not a mystery why we recovered rapidly from that downturn. We knew what brought it on. The Fed raised interest rates. We knew how to reverse it, lower interest rates. And that was the kindling to get the economy going. You had this incredibly rapid growth in housing construction. Also, I should say, car buying being more important to the U.S. economy back then. And that's what got the economy going. Well, that wasn't possible in a recession that's brought on by the collapse of a housing bubble. There was no backlog of housing. There was no pent-up demand to be met. Okay, same with car buying. You know, there was somewhat of a fall off in car buying, so we did some increase in demand, but nothing like what we had coming out of that prior downturn, because it wasn't the result of interest rates. There was no simple story you could say, okay, we're going to lower interest rates, and then we're going to take off again. So you had to have something to fill this gap, to fill the gap created by this fall off in construction and fall off in consumption. I should also point out, you know, another part of the story that, you know, certainly shouldn't be overlooked is that state and local governments, you had it here in Wisconsin, you had it everywhere, state and local governments had a lot of money coming in at the peak of the bubble because house prices were so high, people were paying high property taxes, that, of course, disappeared. Okay, so that was another source of strain, and, you know, state and local governments respond to that by laying off workers. You know, part of the stimulus was designed to counter that. You know, so in 2009, 2010, there was a lot of money coming to the federal government so that states could maintain the level of services, maintain level of employment. But that ended in 2010, or mostly ended in 2010, and after that, you saw big cutbacks at the state and local level, which, again, is the opposite of what we saw after other recessions. You saw growth in state and local spending, growth in state and local employment, which helped to boost the economy out of the downturn. Okay, well, just to, you know, sort of sum up, you know, how you see the economy, you know, again, as I say, the economy, I think, is often too simple for economists to understand. Demand comes from four places, consumption and investment. If you want, you could break out investment in residential, non-residential, government spending and net exports. Okay, so five if we break out those two components of investment. There's nothing else. I mean, everything falls in those categories. So it's got to come from one of those places. I won't talk about government. I just did talk about government. We don't like government, you know, so government's not going to boost the economy. Yeah, I'm being sarcastic here, but I mean, that's, you know, that's the politics. So we're not going to get it from government. So it's got to come from one of the other places. Well, consumption, you know, as I was saying, consumption was driven by the housing bubble. You have a lot of people running around, oh, if only consumers were more optimistic, you know, they'd be spending more, blah, blah, blah. These people have to look at the data. Consumers are actually spending a lot right now. Okay, they aren't spending as much relative to their income at the peak of the, as they were at the peak of the bubble, but that's because the wealth is gone. Okay, if you look at the savings rate, or however you want to put it, the percentage of disposable income that's being consumed, it's at the highest levels it's been except for the peak of the housing bubble in, you know, 2002 to 2006, and the peak of the stock bubble, 98 to 2000. Again, stock wealth effect, same story. Okay, consumption is actually high, not low. Okay, so the people are running around going, oh, why isn't consumers aren't spending? They have to look at the data. They are spending. Okay, so that's really not a mystery. They're trying to explain something that isn't there, which is should be hard to do. A lot of explanations, but, you know, they don't make any sense. So, you know, people are saying consumers aren't spending. What will get them to spend? They'll be more optimistic. No, it doesn't make any sense. They're spending about as much as we should reasonably expect them to spend. You know, one of the things, one of my other areas of research is Social Security, and we always have people running around saying people don't save enough. Well, you can't both have a problem with people not saving enough and that they're not spending. You know, you either spend or save it. You can't do both. So anyhow, it's a lot of confusion there. We should not expect more consumption we're seeing. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. Investment, people talk about firms not investing. Well, the investment as a share of GDP, and here I'm pulling out housing. I'll come back to housing in a second. It's almost back to the pre-recession level. We're almost back to the same share we were at in 06, 07. We're a little bit lower, about a half percentage point lower. That's not going to create a boom in the economy. And the idea that investment, you know, again, people are saying firms are pessimistic, blah, blah, blah. If you look at capacity utilization levels, they're still very low in many sectors of the economy, particularly in manufacturing, which is where you see a disproportionate share of the investment. So it really should not be a surprise. In fact, if anything, I'd say the levels of investment we're seeing today are surprisingly high, given how much excess capacity we have. Okay, so the idea that, you know, we should expect a lot more investment, I'm not saying it couldn't increase a little bit, but the idea that we're somehow going to have a takeoff of investment and you have a lot of people complaining, oh, with Obamacare and regulations and taxes, that's why firms aren't investing. Well, you know, again, they basically are. I mean, you could always say it could be a little higher, but it's not realistic to expect it to be much higher. And I just, you know, again, another point of comparison. If you look at investment today compared to the mid-90s, you know, we did have kind of a boom in the late 90s having to do with the internet bubble, also having a Y2K bubble. But if you compare our levels of investment today relative to what they were, say, 93 to 95, it's a little bit higher today as a share of GDP. So no one thought investment was low in those years. So again, investment is not particularly low. That story just doesn't make any sense. Housing is still depressed. The housing share of GDP is around 3%. The normal, if we look back over the last three decades prior to the bubble, would have been a little over 4% of GDP. You look at the number of homes being built, we're somewhere around 600,000. We might think normal's around 1 million. So there's definitely some room for housing construction. But there's a very simple story. The reason why you aren't seeing more homes built, it's not that house prices are low. House prices are pretty much at their trend level. They're not at their bubble level. They're pretty much, in fact, they're above their trend level, I should say. They're about 10% above their trend level. They're not back to their bubble level, which I consider a good thing. But the story, reason why we aren't seeing more construction is very simple. We still have a very high vacancy rate. Okay, the vacancy rate had hit record highs during the downturn. It's fallen back, but it's still well above the pre-bubble levels. Okay, we're about two-thirds of the way back to the pre-bubble vacancy rates. By the way, one of the things that should have, you know, if Alan Greenspan had been paying attention to the economy, one of the reasons why he should have known that we had a bubble was if he looked at the vacancy rate, and this is data that the Commerce Department publishes every quarter, so he didn't have to go snooping, you know, for it. The Commerce Department publishes it. The vacancy rate was already at record levels in 2004, 5, and 6. Okay, that should have said a lot. I mean, if you think about it, you saw house prices going through the roof, and, you know, simple story, supply and demand, you go, okay, well, house prices are going through the roof, that might make sense if there's a real shortage of housing, but if there's a real shortage of housing, why do we have record vacancy rates? Okay, that doesn't make sense. I mean, there were other things you could point out that weren't consistent with that either. I mean, rents, for example, weren't going anywhere. So why are people willing to pay so much more to buy a home but not to rent an apartment or rent a home for that matter? Didn't make any sense, so people should have seen that. But again, vacancy rates, as I say, they'd gone to record highs. They're lower than the levels they were at in 2009, 2010, but they're still well above where they were in the 90s. Okay, so when you have very high vacancy rates, shouldn't be a surprise that you don't see builders anxious to go out and build because they know there's a lot of houses that could come on the market. I should also point out, this is something I think there's often a lot of confusion on because you hear a lot of people talk about series, the realtors keep a series, inventory of unsold homes. But those are homes that are just listed for sale. You have a lot of people that might have a vacant home that, you know, they're thinking, oh, I'll keep it off the market for 6 months, a year, whatever, prices will get back up. I think that's a much better measure of what the underlying state of the market is than the number of homes that people actually have put up for sale. And it's not that hard to put up a home for sale. So in other words, if you have a vacant home and you're thinking that prices will go up in, you know, a few months and, you know, or conditions will change, it's not hard for you to decide, okay, time to put it on the market. So I think, you know, if we want a good sense of the underlying state of the market, I think the vacancy rate is a much better measure than these measures of inventory. Okay, so again, that's still well above pre-bubble levels, and that's going to keep housing construction depressed for at least a few years into the future. I mean, it will continue to come back. I expect we'll build more homes in 2014 than we did in 2013, and 2015 than we did in 2014. We probably won't get back to normal levels till maybe 2016. Okay, so that will provide a boost to the economy, but still not get us back to full employment. Okay, well, the part of the story that for whatever reason economists don't like to talk about, I'm saying that seriously, I don't think there is a good reason. I could think of bad reasons. The part of the story they don't like to talk about is the trade deficit. And it's just kind of bizarre because we could argue about trade policy. You know, we could all have different ideas on trade policy. Do we think things like NAFTA were a good deal or now the Trans-Pacific Partnership? You could have that argument, and, you know, I don't mind telling you I thought they're bad deals, but, you know, but that's aside the point. This is just a matter of definitions. Okay, if we have a trade deficit, which we do, about $500 billion a year, about 3% GDP, that's money that's being spent elsewhere. It's not being spent in the United States. It's not creating demand in the United States. So all of us, we're making our money, we're, you know, working for a living or getting our Social Security checks, whatever it might be. That's money being generated in the United States. It then gets spent in Mexico, Canada, Europe, China, wherever it might be. It's not creating demand in the United States. That creates a big gap in demand. Okay, $500 billion a year, 3% of GDP. It's a big gap in demand. Well, in the bubble years, you go back to 2002, 2006, 2007, we filled that gap in demand with the bubble. Okay, that's one way you could do it. Not a real good way, but that is a way to do it. Okay, well, we're not filling that gap now. We don't have another bubble. That's a very big gap in demand. And I should point out, it's even larger than that 3% would indicate, because if you think about it a moment, it's very similar. Suppose I snap my fingers. I got the trade deficit down to zero. I don't mean to say we have to get down to zero, but let's just, for purposes of examining it. Suppose we snapped our fingers, we got, you know, eliminated 3% of this 3% of GDP that's going abroad instead is going here. That's basically the same thing as if we had a government spending program, a stimulus of 3% of GDP. We expect, you know, most economists would agree, say a multiplier of 1.5. That would mean that we would raise GDP by about 4.5 percentage points. Okay, ballpark number, that translates into roughly 6 million jobs. Okay, so this is a big deal. There's a lot at stake with the trade deficit. Okay, so as I say, economists don't like to talk about it. And again, I don't quite know why, because, you know, again, we all use the same accounting. You know, in other words, it's not like I have an accounting and they have an accounting and they're using different accounting. You know, we're using the same accounting. So if we have a trade deficit of 3 percentage points of GDP, that has to be filled somehow. Okay, and I would just say you don't have a way to do it. I mean, I have a way to do it. I mean, you know, I'm fine with government stimulus. Let's, you know, spend a lot of money improving the education system, you know, modernizing our transportation system, retrofitting buildings. I mean, I can give them the list, but that's not happening. Okay, so if that doesn't happen, how do you fill that? Okay, and they don't have an answer to that. They don't have an answer. I don't know anyone give you a good answer for that. All right, my answer for it is if we can't do it any other way, get the dollar down. That is why we have the trade deficit. Okay, it's really not a mysterious story. We actually did not used to have large trade deficits. It's kind of funny because we've had large trade deficits since the late 90s. You have a lot of people acting like, oh, that's just a fact of nature. The United States always run large trade deficits. I have some friends that should know better who say, oh, well, we have to run trade deficits because we're the reserve currency. That's nonsense. Okay, just a couple points just to demonstrate that's nonsense. We actually had surpluses through the 50s, the 60s, into the 70s, and guess what? The dollar was the reserve currency in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. It literally is just nonsense. We don't have to have a trade deficit. The way other countries got dollars was we invested there. And back in the old days, economists, you know, the economic theory I learned when I was in grad school was rich countries are supposed to run trade surpluses. Okay, that's supposed to help poor countries develop. Capital flows from where it's plentiful, the rich countries, to where it's scarce, the poor countries. It's supposed to help them develop. Okay, so, you know, the idea the United States has to run a trade deficit because we're the reserve currency, that's just nonsense. The other part of the story, did we always run one? Again, we didn't run one in the 50s, 60s, into the 70s. First began to run modest deficits in the 70s because of the OPEC price increases. That's when we first began to run deficits. They became large in the early 80s, mid-80s, and there's a simple reason for it. The dollar soared. Okay, the dollar rose a lot, 82, 83. This is a outcome of the high interest rate policy I talked about earlier. The dollar rose a lot, and that led to large trade deficits. So the trade deficit went from around 1% of GDP to over 3%, or I should say over, it peaked at about 3% of GDP in 86. Then it came down, and a great story to my view, this is Reagan, so not exactly, you know, our most left-wing president. In 86, they had what was referred to as a Plaza Accord. We negotiated a decline in the value of the dollar with what were then our major trading partners, the UK, France, Germany, Japan. And they had an orderly decline in the dollar, and the trade deficit came down with it. Okay, it's exactly what, you know, you'd expect. So when the dollar falls by 10%, what that means, other things equal, and it's a little more complicated than this, but if the dollar falls by 10%, that means imports from other countries are 10% more expensive for people in the United States, so we'll buy less imports, more domestically produced goods. And our exports are 10% cheaper for people living in other countries. They're going to buy more of our exports. That's kind of the textbook story. And that fits very well what actually happened in the late 80s. Okay, so we had, after that, relatively modest trade deficits. I know some of us, including me, thought they were too large. They were around 1% of GDP. But that was through to the mid-90s. And then we had a big event that changed everything, the East Asian financial crisis. Okay, you might recall this was back in 97. And, you know, one country after another, it began in Thailand and then Korea, Malaysia, Indonesia. All the countries in that region faced a serious financial crisis. They had large amounts of money flowing into the country. Suddenly, it all went out. Okay, and that led to a crisis. They could not support their currencies. They had to turn to the IMF for a bailout. And condition the IMF bailout was, okay, you're going to pay your bills. Okay, you're not going to have a write down of your debt. You're going to pay your bills. The way you're going to do it is you're going to lower the value of your currency and you're going to export like crazy. And them lowering the value of their currency meant raising the value of the dollar. And if you look at what happened, the dollar rose a lot against all these currencies. And our trade deficit soared. Okay, so the trade deficit went from a little over 1% GDP in 95 to it was close to 4% GDP by 2000, eventually peaked at 6% GDP in 2006. Okay, so we're down somewhat from 2006, part of that because of the recession. Okay, but in any case, the trade deficit first became really large following the East Asian financial crisis. Now, one reason why you may not hear a lot of people talking about this, anyone know who engineered the bailout of the East Asian financial crisis? Big actors, anyone? Excuse me? Stiglitz wasn't in on it, no. No, this is 97. Someone else was in the White House. Rubin, Robert Rubin, Larry Summers, and Alan Greenspan. There's a great picture, a cover of Time magazine. Look it up, Committee to Save the World. Google it. They engineered the East Asian financial crisis. Okay, to my mind, one of the biggest economic blunders we've ever seen. Okay, because it sent the dollar soaring. It gave us this large trade deficit. And, you know, I was on a panel with Larry Summers the other day and going, wow, I actually agree with most of what he's saying. But he gave us this problem. He talks about secular stagnation, and he goes, oh, it's a problem people aren't consuming enough. Well, I go, no, first and foremost, it's a problem we have a really large trade deficit, which, you know, guess what? So that's, I think, one reason why people don't talk about it. So we got a badly overvalued dollar, and as a result of that, we have a very large trade deficit and no easy way to fill that gap in demand. Okay, so when people look at the downturn and go, oh, why is it lasting so long? Why is it hard to recover? Well, I'm sort of going, why would you expect otherwise? Okay, why would you expect anything otherwise? Okay, so let me just sort of quickly go through policies that we could do, should do, probably won't do, but, you know, what we could do to talk about getting, you know, getting back to something like full employment. Okay, first off, just the obvious one, stimulus. I mean, it's, you know, it really is kind of painful at this point that, you know, we're arguing over whether stimulus worked, whether, you know, that could boost demand. You know, the logic of stimulus is fairly straightforward. You have a gap in demand, and you fill that by having the government spend money. Okay, normal times, you know, and we get all our conservative economists that go, oh, it's just going to crowd out investment. There's an argument for that. You know, if the unemployment rate were 4% and, you know, I got this great program, I want to spend $100 billion on repairing our roads or whatever it might be, well, probably a lot of that will crowd out investment, okay, because there's a limited amount of people I could hire and, you know, we will push up interest rates. There's something to be said for that. I mean, I think even in those times they're probably exaggerating, but, you know, I could grant that. But in this situation, you know, if we were to spend money retrofit, you know, hiring construction workers, a lot of unemployed construction workers still, hiring them to retrofit buildings so that they're more energy efficient, put up solar panels so that, you know, they don't have to use as much fossil fuel. Lots of things we could do with money, you know, hire back a lot of people have been laid off in the last 2 or 3 years, you know, at state and local level, in education and healthcare. Lots of things we could do. Okay, and, you know, again, to my mind, the evidence is just overwhelming. It's sort of striking to me, you know, and, you know, Obama's a guy who got elected twice, so maybe I shouldn't question his political instincts, but they really, really blew that on the stimulus. You know, and what I'm saying they blew it is they oversold it, and they knew they were overselling it. At least all the economists, you know, maybe they're covering their rears, but, you know, they all say, oh, we knew it wasn't big enough. And what I mean by this is, you know, they had a stimulus by their own calculations. They projected it would create somewhere around 2 to 3 million jobs. Well, we knew you needed somewhere around 10 to 12 million jobs. Okay, so 2 to 3 million jobs is great, but that's not going to get you back to full employment if you need 10 to 12. But yet, they led people to believe that. So, you know, on the one hand, they had the report, it was co-authored by my friend, Jared Bernstein, that said, oh, the unemployment rate won't get above 8% if we have this stimulus package. Well, needless to say, the Republicans had a field day, because obviously the unemployment rate got way above 8%. Okay, it wasn't because the stimulus didn't do what they expected it to do, it was because the baseline was much worse than what they thought. Okay, so they never tried to say, and he could have done that the first day, you know, so the Republicans couldn't claim you're backtracking. He could have done this in February. If you go back, February 2009, if you go back during that period, we were losing about 700,000 jobs a month. Now, that wasn't in their forecast. So they could have said, you know, people who hated Obama, you know, for whatever reason, they would still say, oh, the guy's born in Kenya and everything. But the point was, for anyone who was at all open-minded, if he gets up in February, the day after the stimulus passed, and goes, you know, this is a great first step, but the hole's deeper than we thought, they couldn't say, oh, that's because you messed up policies. It's a little hard to blame him. He's been in office 1 month and hasn't done anything. So anyhow, so he oversold the stimulus, and then he said we have to pivot to deficit reduction. Just mind-boggling, you know, just mind-boggling. So at a time when, again, all his economic advisors, Larry Summers, Christy Romer, all the top advisors say we knew it wasn't enough, he's talking about deficit reduction, puts deficit reduction on the agenda, and takes stimulus off the agenda. You know, again, I mean, the politics on that just seem to me horrible, and it's made it almost impossible to do anything by way of serious stimulus. All right, so, I mean, that would get do a lot. We could create jobs. Again, the evidence is, and there's been a lot of research on stimulus in the United States, created jobs. There's some great cross-country stuff that you could just look at the countries that cut the most, cut their budgets the most because they've been cutting the last 4 years, have seen the worst growth performance, the worst employment performance, the ones that stimulated the most had the best record. So, you know, again, you can beat it up any way you like. I think it's hard to make that result go away. So stimulus will create jobs, create growth. A second route, and this is more controversial, and, you know, I'd say why not try it. I can't say it would necessarily work. Paul Krugman's the main advocate of this. I mean, others have picked it up. He was the one who originally proposed it. If you deliberately tried to have a higher rate of inflation, the logic here, the Federal Reserve Board would say, okay, we're going to target, you know, 3% inflation or 4% inflation, and what that means is we'll do whatever is necessary to raise the inflation rate to, you know, this target, 3%, 4%, meaning we'll just keep buying bonds. Most people probably heard about the quantitative easing program. So they buy government bonds, buy mortgage-backed securities. So rather than saying we're going to buy $80 billion a month, I think we've now tapered to 60. I forget what the exact number is where we're at in their tapering. We're buying less than we used to. But instead of putting a quantity on it, you just say we're going to buy whatever it takes to get the inflation rate up to, you know, 3% or 4%. Okay, and you try to convince the markets you're going to do that. Well, the logic of this is to lower the real interest rate. What that means, if people want to borrow money, you know, that you could do it on a home, you know, get a mortgage at, you know, 4.5% or whatever it might be. Firms are borrowing money from banks or on bond markets. So whatever they're paying, you know, that they'll keep paying whatever that interest rate is, more or less. But they're going to know, let's say they target 4% inflation, 5 years from now, everything they sell is going to sell for roughly 20% more. Okay, so that should make it more profitable to invest. Okay, whether that would work or not, the current government in Japan, Abe, the new prime minister, I guess he's not that new anymore, Prime Minister Abe, is trying something like this in Japan. Seems to be working so far. You know, you could argue either way. I think most evidence suggests it's working. Whether that would work, I could say, you know, I can't say for sure. My view is I don't see a downside. What happens? What happens if it doesn't work? I have economists who disagree with me strongly and go, oh, well, they wouldn't raise inflation. It's harder to raise inflation than you think. So what? Okay, then nothing happened. I mean, what's the downside? I mean, that's what I always say. I mean, obviously, you know, you hope your policies will work, but if there's no real downside, you know, you tried it, it didn't work, we're just back where we were, what's the downside? So anyhow, I would love to see the Fed try something like that. I don't think it's going to. I shouldn't say don't think. I'm quite sure it's not going to, but, you know, that would be another way to deal with it. Okay, the third route is, you know, pretty much the route I was just telling you with lower the value of the dollar. And I think over long term, that has to happen. You know, a real question is, you know, when, how fast. I think we will see a decline in the value of the dollar. Part of the fallout from 97, and it's really quite striking, part of the fallout from 97, it wasn't just the East Asian countries. Basically, every developing country in the world that was in a position to run a trade surplus and to begin to accumulate reserves did so. So it wasn't just the East Asian countries. China, actually, that was the first time China really began to run very large trade surpluses. China shifted in a very big way towards running large trade surpluses, but also Latin American countries. So really, it was a worldwide phenomenon. And, you know, I expect that to be reversed at some point. The question is whether we start to see that reversed, you know, 2014, 15, 16, or, you know, we're waiting towards the end of the decade or even the next decade. Okay, but that really, to my view, should be a priority. And, you know, again, I think it is a fairly simple matter. People in Washington often talk about China manipulating the currency, and I kind of don't like that. I mean, a couple reasons. One is I think it often tends to be a little racist. Maybe a lot of racists, but the other point is, you know, the whole term manipulating, like we're going to catch them, you know, we're going to go in the dark and, you know, turn our flashlight on and catch them, and there's nothing to catch them with. They have a pegged exchange rate. It's not a secret. They peg their exchange rate. It's quite open. and they buy up large amounts of U.S. assets, primarily U.S. government bonds, to keep their currency from rising. So it's not like we really have to catch them doing something. They're doing it openly. And, you know, the point is it hurts us. And, you know, we don't expect, you know, we're not going to tell China, hey, you have to stop that. You negotiate. You know, you negotiate. So we negotiate with them on things all the time. We're telling them they have to respect Microsoft's copyrights on, you know, Windows. And, you know, they have to respect Pfizer's patents. They have to open up their financial markets to J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs. Well, I changed that list. You know, I don't care about those things. I want them to raise the value of their currency against the dollar. You know, and, you know, I think the reason that doesn't happen is because all those other items are very high on the list. You know, maybe somewhere along the way we mention, oh, we also want you to raise the value of their currency. But, you know, it doesn't work that way, certainly not when we're negotiating with China. We can maybe do that with Guatemala. We can't do that with China. Okay, so anyhow, so I'd make that a very high priority. Clearly it's not. Okay, the last point, last way in which you could try to get back to full employment is sort of taking the other channel. All of these things we're talking about are about raising demand. So we're going to have more growth, more demand in the economy, and that way we'll have more people employed. Well, another way you could think about that, if we don't have enough demand in the economy, essentially this is actually a story, it's something that, you know, to my mind, funny, maybe funny is not the right word, strange to think about. It's really a story of too much wealth, not too little wealth. The story here is, you know, most of us are reasonably well-fed, clothed, you know, housed. You know, obviously people could use more, but, you know, the idea is that we're producing, you know, enough to support our population, and we all need everyone's work. Okay, well, what can you do? How about we share the work? Okay, if that sounds absurd, I'll give you somewhere where it's done, Germany. Okay, I hear a lot of people talk about Germany and go, oh, you know, Germany's got this great booming economy. Well, they haven't looked at the data. Germany's economy's grown no more rapidly. In fact, I hear less rapidly than the U.S. economy. Okay, the unemployment rate in Germany in their latest numbers is 5.1%. They went into the downturn with an unemployment rate of 7.7%. Okay, so their unemployment rate today is 2.6 percentage points below what it was at the start of the downturn. Ours, on the other hand, we went to the downturn with an unemployment rate of 4.5%, so we're 2 percentage points higher. Okay, but we had the same growth. We had a hair more growth. Well, what happened? Well, Germany has a number of policies that encourage firms to keep people on the job and work fewer hours rather than lay them off. Okay, and it's been incredibly successful. Okay, so that's the sort of thing I would love to see here. We actually have that to some extent. It's not widely taken up. I don't think Wisconsin has this, but 26 states have work-sharing programs that are part of their unemployment insurance system. So what that means is that if you have an employer that wants to cut off, you know, they seem to fall off in demand, they would otherwise lay off 20% of their workers. They could instead, under the work-sharing program, cut back everyone's hours by 20%. If they get laid off, they get basically half their pay as unemployment benefits. Well, if they cut back their hours by 20%, they could have half of that made up in through this work-sharing program, so they only see a 10% cut in their pay. So in that story, people are working 20% fewer hours, they're taking home 10% less pay. That has to be a better story. Okay. Now, unfortunately, the take-up on that is very low. So if you look at the numbers of people on the work-sharing program, I haven't looked at the most recent numbers, but it's somewhere around 30,000. It had been higher, but it's still very much underutilized. It's the sort of thing that, you know, I would love to see us promote more. And, you know, one of the points I make on this is it actually is something that has bipartisan support. And I'm not totally sure why that is, but I do know for certain. I've actually written a few things with Kevin Hassett, who's a conservative economist. He was an advisor to Romney. He's totally for work sharing. You know, he looked at the situation in Germany. He goes, we should be able to do it here. He got Boehner supportive of it. Boehner, in 2012, there was actually an amendment attached to the bill that extended the payroll tax cut. You remember we had the 2 percentage point payroll tax cut. They extended it for another year. And as an amendment to that, they had a provision that has the federal government picking up the cost of state work-sharing programs through 2014. There's also money for them to modernize it because the programs that are in place are mostly date back from the 70s, early 80s, so they need to be modernized, need to be computerized in many cases. So there was actually money for that. So this is something that enjoys bipartisan support. So that's something I would like to see more of. I should also point out, you could think of work sharing in different ways. One of the big differences between the United States and Europe is, you know, you look across Western Europe, everyone has paid vacation. Okay, to be in the European Union, you have to guarantee workers 4 weeks a year of paid vacation. Okay, many countries, my wife's Danish, they had a general strike there about 10, 12 years ago, because workers at that time had 5 weeks a year of paid vacation, they wanted six. Okay, they compromised, they got 5.5, you know. So you know, they have a lot more paid vacation. Everyone's got paid sick days, paid parental leave. You know, it varies, of course, country by country. Some more generous, some less. But, you know, these are all ways of reducing work time, which, you know, I think most people would really value. So these are sorts of things. One of the things that's nice about those measures, those could be done at the state and local level. You know, you do have some states. California has paid parental leave now at the state level. The number of cities around the country have paid sick days, mandatory paid sick days. So that's something that can be done at the state and local level. Last point I'll just mention in that respect is the Affordable Care Act, something that the Obama administration, people hate it when I talk about this, but I think it's important. I mean, the Affordable Care Act extends insurance, and that's important. That's a great thing. But to my mind, what's even more important is all the people who have insurance on their job now know that if they leave their job, if they lose their job, quit their job, they could still get insurance. Okay, that's a really, really big deal. And what I expect to see over the course of the next few years is you will see a lot of people take advantage of it. They'll quit their job. You know, say, I hate this job. You know, I want a job I like more. You know, they might take a period of time out of the labor market. I don't mean to say everyone could just quit and, live on their savings. I know most people can't. But a lot of people might say, okay, I've been working 40 hours a week because that's the only way I can get insurance. I'd rather work part-time. You know, you have a lot of parents with small kids. Maybe they want to work 30 hours a week, but they can't get insurance at 30 hours a week. Now they can get insurance. Okay, so I think we're going to see that impact. And I actually wrote that up. That was, you know, what I saw as the best good news in this report. There was a big increase, or I shouldn't say a big increase, a modest increase in the number of people voluntarily working part-time. I should emphasize voluntary because I wrote this and someone said, why do you think it's good that people have to work part-time? I said, voluntary, you know. So if people choose to work 30 hours a week rather than 40, I think that's great. Okay, and there was some increase, and I think we'll see more of that. So that's another way in which we could talk about sharing the work. I'll also mention older workers. You have a lot of people, before Medicare age, they're 50s, 60s, often in bad health. You know, they struggle going to work because that's the only way they can afford insurance. Well, you're going to see, I think, some of those people take early retirement. And again, some evidence that's happening. I wouldn't make too much of it, but some evidence that's happening. And again, to my mind, that's a great thing, both for those people. But guess what? You know, if a firm had someone who was 62 in bad health and coming in every day, and now, you know, that person says, okay, I'm quitting, I'll hire someone else. Okay, which is a good story, both sides. Okay, so... Excuse me? Well, that's a way of dealing with getting us closer to full employment. So that's a step in the right direction. So let me just finish up here. What I'll say is that, you know, the prospects of getting back to full employment anytime soon are not great. We have a lot of big obstacles to overcome, but I think there are some things going in the right direction. And, you know, mostly what I could point to is really at the state and local level, you know, mentioning, you know, things like paid family leave, paid parental leave. Also, the other big thing at the state and local level, the minimum wage drives. Okay, those, a lot of states, local governments around the country are making headway on that. And that does have a big impact. So, you know, if we can get the federal legislation through, which I don't think is absurd, by the way. The Gingrich Congress passed an increase in the minimum wage in 1996. So I don't think it's absurd to think this Congress might pass an increase in minimum wage before they go home. Face the voters in November. So I don't think that's absurd. But regardless of what happens in Congress, that can happen at the state and local level. So long and short, we got a long way to go, but I think there are some grounds for optimism. So I'll stop with that. Thank you.
You've been listening to Dean Baker speaking on Unemployment and Inequality, A Path Forward, held on April 4th, 2014, and sponsored by the Madison Institute. For free downloads of Dean Baker's books, go to the Center for Economic Policy and Research website at www.cepr.net. CEPR.net. To listen to more thought-provoking programs sponsored by the Madison Institute, go to our website at www.themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the sponsors.